Okay, so the idea is that I'll discuss black holes as far as sources of gamma ray bursts, and it's going to be very informal because, perforce, because what I've been working on mostly is on what happens after you have the initial source which delivers energy in a very short time, in a very short, very small volume. And so I've been looking at what happens after that, how you produce the gamma ray bursts. But for this conference, the interesting thing, more interesting thing for this workshop is what the progenitors are. And so, you know, in the context of gamma ray bursts, you know, the big question has been what triggers them and what determines the time scale. And then the other things are, you know, how do you produce the gamma rays, etc. The typical numbers that we have, you all know about them, redshifts cosmological, from the fluences you determine, you know, how much energy is involved. It's of the order of the binding energy of a solar mass, modulus some beaming factor, which could be 10 to the minus 1 or 10 to the minus 2, but in some cases there is no evidence for beaming. There is only one documented case where there appears to be decent evidence for beaming. In the others, we don't have evidence, we just suspect it. Well, there is a light curve. Okay, I'm not going, since I'm going to talk about black holes. All right, the evidence is... The evidence is that there is these latest gamma ray bursts, January 23, log nu, log f nu. There is a, it has two unusual features. The typical afterglow in the optical has been one where you have, you know, a power law. And everybody understood that power law is coming from the forward shock. And you know, one expects that if one has a jet, you know, then at some point it is going out highly relativistically. And at some point it becomes non-relativistic, let's say out here. Then, you know, it should certainly start expanding because, you know, it will become, you know, essentially... somewhere it will become subsonic, etc. It will get sideways expansion. In fact, somewhat before that, you expect that the, you know, if gamma goes to 1, sometime before that, the speed will become c over square root of 3, so you'll have to, you'll start getting expansion out here. But there is another effect, too, and that is that, you know, at some point, gamma will become equal to 1 over the opening angle. And so before that, your effective area, you know, increased, so your effective transverse area is proportional to perpendicular area times 1 over gamma squared. And since gamma is dropping, the transverse area is growing as gamma drops. But after gamma becomes... drops to a value 1 over the opening angle, then that becomes proportional to r perpendicular times theta jet squared. So, and it, you know, r perpendicular is t proportional to t times gamma squared. So here you have something which is proportional to gamma squared, whereas here you have something which is proportional to gamma fourth. And gamma drops in time, it's t to the minus some power, 3/8 typically. I cannot go into that. But so the point is that you expect the light curve to do something like that if you have gone to that point where gamma is equal to 1 over theta. So until now that had never been seen, but for these particular burst, something like that has been seen. The drop is precisely by 2 powers of gamma. It's about minus, the flux, when you translate that into, you know, transverse area times gamma cubed times commoving intensity, whatever. So the drop is by the right amount. So this is the first time there seems to be some evidence for a jet. But in five or six previous optical afterglows, one just saw an uninterrupted thing. There is another in these one burst. This doesn't belong here, but there is also something that looks like evidence for a reverse shock or perhaps for an internal shock. So actually, it's an interesting burst. It shows three breaks, but we think we understand that. That's not relevant to beaming. That seems to be relevant to beaming. Sorry?
The value of the jet you get.
It depends a little bit on what to assume, but of the order maybe of 3 degrees or thereabouts, 3 to 5 degrees. Is that right, Aline? Yeah.
So you're just, how are you calculating the expansions?
The thing is, here you don't need to calculate expansion. When you get to this point, the thing continues to expand without expand.
How do you know how the gamma is dropping with time? That must be because you're sweeping up something.
The gamma drops in time because you're sweeping up something. Yeah, you're sweeping up matter in front of it. Right.
So what? But is it you're doing it by matching Rand pressure? You're doing it. By
Yeah.
But when you do a radio galaxy evolution. Uh-huh. And yeah. It's a very light jet, and yeah. The early time evolution, it tends to expand as a spherical spherical bubble. It's a heavy jet. No, it can't be a heavy jet, otherwise it wouldn't decelerate.
It's a light jet, of course. It's relativistic. It's a relativistic fluid, but it's expanding against something. Now, the typical deceleration one computes in the spherical approximation, and the argument, then one just makes the argument that, for a jet you get the same thing as before, as long as gamma is less than 1 over theta, then there is no difference between a sphere and a jet.
I guess what I'm saying is that from my experience dealing with models of radio galaxies, double radio galaxies, mm-hmm. The more relativistic you make them, mm-hmm. The more the effect that they have on the surrounding medium is like an isotropic release of energy. So I'm wondering why you don't fill up this entire bubble with relativistic fluid.
Well, you probably do, but most of the emission, I think, comes from the hot spot, and that's what we're calculating here, and that's what probably we see. I mean, we probably do have a shell and the bubble and all that, but it's lower surface density, and all that has not been calculated and doesn't seem to be observed.
The distance jet, you start with a serrated jet, even if you have a much larger mass here than our medium, because this relativistic effect, you can have a gamma Lorentz up to lower mass of the swept matter than in the jet. And you start to select it.
So is the gamma that you're observing the gamma of the shock or the gamma of the jet?
Well, the contact discontinuity and the forward shock, they differ only by a factor of square root of 2, right? The gamma. Yeah. So anyway, I'm happy to talk more about jets and gamma rays, but you wanted me to talk about black holes.
What you have first.
Yeah. I mean, that's the stuff I work on more. But so anyway, that's the type of energies. And so how do you produce them? Now, the candidates that have been largely... that have been discussed as plausible. The most obvious one is neutron star mergers, because we have observed a few neutron star binaries in the galaxy. We know they exist. We can estimate how many of them will merge within a Hubble time. And we find that the rate of merging of neutron star binaries, as extrapolated from observations, is of the order of 1 per million year per galaxy. And that's about the rate at which Patsy observes such mergers. One can estimate the number of neutron star black hole binaries, and their numbers may be even slightly higher. And clearly the kind of energy you liberate when you get these merger is going to be of the order of a solar rest mass, here somewhat larger because black holes are somewhat more massive.
Wait, when you said that's the rate at which Batsy observed such mergers.
Such bursts. Bursts, so that's the rate at which Batsy observed bursts, it coincides the rate with the presumed rate of mergers. So, you know, if you put, you estimate how many, you know, how many of such mergers you have per galaxy, you extrapolate it out to 300 megaparsecs or so, you get the right amount. You're even comfortable because you can go beyond that, you know. Yes, 100, certainly, yeah. 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 Yeah, redshift of one. So you get more out to redshift of one, certainly. But that's comfortable, you know. You don't observe them all. If they're beamed, you don't see them all, you know. So, and, you know, not all of them need be successful gamma ray bursts. The point is that you don't fall short, at any rate. Okay?
Was it thought that the run-of-the-mill gamma ray burst is
No, you get the log, you know, first of all, there are redshifts only for four of them. Those are 0.86, 0.96, 1.6, and 3.4. The log N, log S type of curves for 2500 burst, if you assume their luminosities are, are as deduced from those four observed ones, then you get that the mean redshift is maybe a order of two. And the maximum redshift might be, well, you don't know exactly, but could easily be five to seven, whatever. So it's hard, you know, it's pushing it. Now, another very plausible progenitor is the collapse of a rotating massive star. Boosley thought of a scheme like that, which he called failed supernova 1b, and Bogdan Paczynski later on thought of a variant of these, which he called a hypernova. Basically, you have a very massive star, it's rotating, collapses, the core collapses to a black hole, and it seems that when you try to do a supernova simulation from such an animal, you don't get a decent supernova. But if it's fast rotating enough, you might evacuate centrifugally a funnel along the rotation axis, where then the density of baryons may be low enough that if you produce a relativistic fluid at the bottom, which could be either magnetic fields or neutrino, antineutrino, electron, positron, fireball, the baryon loading would be low enough that you get a relativistic outflow. I mean, the reason why you need the relativistic outflow, again, I didn't go into that, but the phenomenological model of the gamma ray burst is that you need a relativistic fireball which has Lorentz factors of at least 100. Then you can explain all the gamma rays. So that's all the part I won't talk about. But the point is that all these models, if they want to fit into what we think is doing the gamma rays, then they have to somehow produce a relativistic outflow which has Lorentz factors of at least 100.
I mean, there was one recent gamma ray burst identified a peculiar supernova.
Yes.
Well,
that particular animal is identified it coincides with a supernova which could fit in with a scheme like these, but there are two things about that. The supernova is anomalous. It has a very large radio luminosity, much, much brighter in radio than other supernova known. And as a gamma ray burst, it's also anomalous because it's very, very nearby, a redshift of 0.07 or whatever. So the luminosity, instead of being an equivalent of 10 to the 53 or 10 to the 54 isotropic, it's more like 10 to the 48 isotropic. So it doesn't fit either into the scheme of supernova or into the scheme of gamma ray bursts, but, you know, if one takes some paradigm like these, that, you know, you might have something which is a failed supernova which produces a gamma ray burst, you know, this could be an intermediate object. It could be a fail hypernova, that's right. So, but there, you know, one thing that has that is iffy with these objects is that the probability of random coincidence between the supernova and the object is 10 to the minus 4, which is a low, it's a low probability. But there has, you know, there's been conflicting evidence. Beppo Sachs saw a fading X-ray transient, which was low significance, but they did see something which was not coincident with the supernova. It was off. So, you know, there is some small chance that maybe the supernova is a random coincidence. In any case, if it's not a coincidence, then it's an interesting thing, which, you know, would make sense if you're saying that, that you know, one way to fit it in is you say they all of them have 10 to the 53 or 10 to the 54 ergs energy release, isotropic equivalent. Perhaps that's caused by the fact that you release 10 to the 48, 10 to the 49 ergs, and then you have this incredibly narrow beam of 10 to the minus 4, and that's what simulates the 10 to the 53 in most of the other bursts. That's difficult because you need this incredibly narrow beam, which is very difficult to imagine. Alternatively, you know, yeah, it's relativistic, but you know, it was only a factor, Lorentz factor of 2 or 3. Yeah, so it was unusual for a supernova, right? But for the gamma ray burst, it was very non-relativistic. Yeah. So the other way you could think at the supernova case is that perhaps it was something which has a total energy of 10 to the 53, but you happen to be, you know, so an isotropic equivalent of 10 to the 53, but perhaps, you know, so perhaps that, that is just what you would see if you were looking along the beam, and here you're not looking along the beam, you're looking along the side, and that's why you see, you know, much lower flux. So I'm not going to talk about that too much because it's just too, you know, at the moment it's uncertain. Now another way one could get the systems is with the a merger of a black hole and the helium core of a red giant, a helium, you know, what looks essentially like a helium star, or a white dwarf and black hole. Now all of these scenarios will lead to a black hole eventually, and it's the simulations I'll show indicate that it's the rotation parameter could be relatively high. It ranges from 0.3 to 0.9 something in a few cases. And there is initially a torus of debris around it. Right, in all of these systems, there is either merger or rotation, so you'll get a disruption of, and so you'll get a temporary torus of debris. The mass of the torus, the debris torus, is smallest in this case, the neutron star merger, and it's largest in these more massive things. Of course, then, in terms of binding energy, you have the right amount. The question is, you know, can you make it into something which is a relativistic outflow, which seems to have a similar amount of energy, at least when you, you know, maybe it's less energy but beamed. So, you know, you either have to get that all that energy, the, you know, a good fraction of the binding energy into a relativistic outflow, or a smaller amount but then beam it decently. Okay, so there are two or three groups that have been doing simulations, hardcore simulations. One of them is Max Ruffert, who's now at Edinburgh, and Hans Thomas Janka. Max Ruffert was originally at the Max Planck, so that's where these things got started. And so, you know, so there's a little sketch that Max prepared, which indicates what are the masses of the debris tori that he gets. Mainly he's dealt with these two cases, and these two cases here have been dealt with mainly by Stan Woosley and his collaborators. But you can see that, you know, the mass of the debris torus is different. The amount of rotation expected is different. And this part here, the jet formation, is simulated to a more modest degree, what's better simulated is the formation of the black hole, the disruption, the formation of the torus.
Let's see. So yeah. When a white dwarf turns into a type 1 supernova all by itself, there's no neutron matter, it just explodes. But the statement here is that a black hole white dwarf merger that doesn't happen, instead of the white dwarf is collapsed to neutron density.
That's right. Well, you get, that's right. I mean, you, at any rate, you get a debris torus of the disrupted white dwarf around it, and, you know, by the time it gets close to the black hole, yeah, it will be neutron star densities, roughly.
I would say if it gets close to the black hole, I mean, that's a non-trivial result if people have shown that actually happens.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's a serious calculation showing that this actually happens. Is that right?
There are calculations showing that this particular case occurs. I'll show some of it later. This is Max Ruffert's simulation of a neutron star merger. I mean, there are limitations. It's a Newtonian calculation. And he puts in, He starts them near contact, and so he can calculate very, very nicely the formation of the torus around it, etc. And then, as far as the black hole formation, essentially what he does is that, you know, once things get within a Schwarzschild radius of once he satisfies the criterion that there is enough mass inside what would be the Schwarzschild radius, then he just uses it as a sink. But he does a very good calculation of the things like the neutrino processes and the neutrino annihilation, etc. But it's Newtonian hydro, and the kind of things he gets are something like that. Right. So these are density profiles, and that's a black hole, and this time scale, from what I've seen, this should be milliseconds thereabouts.
But in supernova, yeah, the thermal evolution takes place over seconds, and then it's driven by
that's right. Yeah.
This is going much faster. It's going just hydrodynamically. It's not very important on the short time scale.
Initially not, that's right. No.
So it's just mostly hydro.
Yeah. Okay, so this is a schematic of the phases. Within 5 milliseconds, I guess there is this ejection phase, so the masses that he gets, and
masses the same in this relation,
the masses. Yeah, he takes similar masses. That's right. Things are somewhat different when you take different masses, and then there are some interesting simulations by a Japanese group and Portuguese Tvart, where they have taken unequal masses, and then you get the question of mass transfer. One of the two neutron stars becomes so low mass that it deneutronizes explosively, and you get another strange possibility there. Okay, so let me show a few numbers from a different type of from a different set of calculations. These are calculations that Bob Popham and Stan Woosley and Chris Fryer have done, where they have taken this general paradigm that any of these scenarios will lead to a central black hole whose mass is given here in this column, and the mass transfer, the m dots, are taken from the numerical simulation, but then so they take that and then they do an actual sort of semi-analytic calculation of an accretion disk, so using the the alpha disk prescriptions, and from that they try to find, so here are the values of the alpha viscosity assumed and the rotation parameter of the hole, and so they have just tried to do an analytic simulation of all of these things, which just to explore the range of parameters, because the numerical simulations are expensive, you know, so they try to get rough numbers this way, and then they compute from that neutrino luminosities and radiative efficiencies. The problem is here that the neutrino luminosities, except in a few cases, are rather low. So if you try to power a fireball or a jet out of these neutrino antineutrino annihilation, you'd have to have a very strong beaming, at least 10 to the minus 3. But so here they have some numbers for these five scenarios. The collapsar scenario is that of a fast rotating massive star, and so I guess the interesting things here that they compute are the durations, which essentially are how long would the disk live against just straight accretion given these alpha parameter. And they try to identify this duration with the duration of the gamma ray burst. Of course, you know, the luminosities that they get if they assume neutrino-antineutrino annihilation are low. Although, you know, they would be okay in many cases. You know, these would be the isotropic ones, so a modest beaming is, you know, would get you where you want, I mean, in some cases. And so you see that the durations of the little disk or the little torus around the neutron star and neutron star binaries are shortish. Also, what they get here for a neutron star black hole, essentially it's because the tidal disruption radius is small, so you don't expect your debris torus to be very extended. And so if you have a decent viscosity, it just accretes fairly fast.
I have a couple of questions here.
Yeah.
First, you as a fireball guy don't care very much about the duration, is that right? Because you're going to do the duration out of the fireball?
Well, the thing is that the afterglows are done, you know, for though the afterglows have a duration much longer than any of these durations, so to explain that, you just use the impulsive approximation. When you're trying to explain the gamma ray light curves, you do need that. Okay? You do need that, so that kind of duration tells you how long is the outflow, and then to explain very spiky gamma ray light curves, you actually, you know, the model that works best is that the outflow has internal shocks, and so you get shells of different velocities that collide with each other, and all of that occurs for a duration of time, which is, you know, one of these numbers here.
So you're saying the overall duration of the gamma ray burst itself is maybe 1 second, maybe 100 seconds,
yeah.
1,000 seconds. Will be set by the second.
That's right. Okay. That's right. Yeah.
And then let's see. Another quick question. You mentioned one baryon loading, but I haven't come back to it. That's rather important issue.
Yeah. The issue of baryon loading is not addressed by these calculations because they don't have enough numerical resolution they would need to go over a very large dynamic range ranging from 10 to the 14 grams per cubic centimeter down to, you know, 10 to the minus, you need to get down to very, at least, I don't know, a dynamic range of at least 10 to the 10, if not 10 to the 15, so they cannot handle it yet.
They
can show the formation of a jet, but it's not a relativistic jet. Right. Yes, sorry, but Marek, yeah.
I have some comments about the second scenario, neutron star plus black hole.
Yes.
That tropical concentration neutron star has not to be disrupted. That neutron star will fill up Roche law, will lose mass, smoothly, and due to angular momentum by distribution, neutron star will spiral out instead of in, and then this time of this process of formation of neutron disk, neutron star will last for much longer, even for 100 seconds. There were two papers about this.
Roche may not be correct anyway.
So this is approximate Roche
law. Yeah. It's impossible.
Neutrons are essentially going around like that.
It's
kind of rotating in the rotating frame.
because of, there's no because of
the point. So it's
Using
the math more easily than
they can actually calculate the directionality of this this energy.
Oh yeah, let me get into that. Yeah, I mean, as I was saying, this was just a little, you know, analytic alpha discalculation.
Yeah, that last graph was just a electric discharge. It wasn't any kind of.
Yeah, so it was just right. Okay. Now here are numerical calculations. So let me show you what some of the numerical calculations on the collapse are. So the rotating massive star lead to, and these are a comparison is McFadyen and Woosley. They'll be here at the Gamma Ray Burst Conference. So these are comparison of some of their numerical calculations compared to their little accretion disk simulations. Of the as you can see, you know, pressure, rotation rate, temperature, etc., scale height, and the angular momentum. A lot depends on the initial angular momentum assumed with which the massive red giant is rotating, and is at seven seconds or so. There are 2D simulations, so there are limitations to the calculation.
What is the mass of the disk compared to the mass of the
Well, in this case, the mass of the the mass of the disk is of the order of a few solar masses. The central object is 3 or 4 solar masses.
So alpha disk is a very good
approximation. Yeah, I guess it would be. So this is how it looks like. Yeah. So I guess you might wonder why it agrees. Yeah, but of course, you know, you have fast rotation, etc. Yeah. So here's one snapshot of the velocity vectors, you know, showing the formation of these initials. So there's the, you know, there's the collapse, but then there's the centrifugal barrier forming a sort of torus around it.
In other words, just the dot, is that where it's in circular orbit?
The dots were in circular, yeah, that's right. There's not an alpha disk here, there's a numerical simulation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. They made the alpha disk only to have ideas about.
Yeah, this thing I showed you here, right?
There's no viscosity, right?
Sorry?
There's no viscosity in the simulation.
Well, I don't think they have put in a prescription of a viscosity now.
So it's just whatever the code fit in. So are they controlling the viscosity? I guess the question is, do they?
Well, you have a collapse, you know. Okay, so whatever you put into a supernova code, they put into here too. Now I haven't checked what that is. I don't know. So if I go back and I read, I may be able to answer you. But right now, I don't know.
We can ask in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Okay, but so these little crosses are the numerical calculations, and the lines where the alpha disk fits to it.
And the basic idea is the disk exists inside a subradius like 10 to the 7.
Yeah.
And outside of it, it's just involved, and that's why there's such a discrepancy between the disk model and the disk model.
Right. So they kind of.
In principle, I would expect a subradius different disk.
Okay, so here.
Strongest argument.
Okay, so here.
The density, the mass of this comparable.
All right.
Very slight.
Yeah. So So these are some of the numbers that they get out of their calculation. Things depend on what is assumed for the initial rotation rate, and so these are numerically estimated durations and typical radius of the disk that forms and amount of mass that is accreted. So the initial black hole, in some of these cases was 2-3 solar masses, so there is additional mass that gets accreted. And
so the basic message is this is not totally crazy. The time scales are about right. The luminosities are rather low, but if you imagine some beaming factors, then they're impossible.
The luminosities are low. Now here is where they play with the Blandford-Znaek mechanism. I guess there is another table which I haven't included, but there are somewhere they compute what the A values will be that they come up with. Okay, so in some cases they have relatively high A values. So if they play the Blandford-Znaek game and they assume it works, okay, of course it scales with the magnetic field, the square of the magnetic field in the torus, and this is the amount you get if you assume that the magnetic field energy density is 1% of rho v squared. So they compute rho v squared and they say, let me assume that magnetic energy density is 1% of that. Then this is the kind of Blandford-Znaek luminosities they get. Of course, that's isotropic. Now, if you're willing to believe that the magnetic field grows to more than 1% of equipartition, you can of course boost that by up to 10^4, because 10^17 would be about the equipartition value. That's right, that it emits considerable amounts or doesn't emit considerable amounts. So these two would be significant gravitational wave sources, right? Yeah.
When you say Blandford-Znaek flux, what are you assuming for the surface area of the region that contains this magnetic flux?
What they assume is that they just make an estimate of what would be the magnetic fields in the inner zone, which is just outside the horizon. But their calculation.
If you make it 10 times bigger, you get 100 times more flux.
Yeah, but of course, then your rho v squared is less. So, you...
The pressure maximum of the disk is mm-hmm. quite a few Schwarzschild radii out, particularly if the disk is thick.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's say that the pressure maximum is at 6 or 8 Schwarzschild radii, or something like this. Then you get a big increase in this. I mean, it's not really Blandford-Znaek effect, it's more of a Blandford and Payne or
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's a disk. It would be a magnetic field in the disk. But I think that, let's see. So I guess probably they use here a misnomer for Blandford-Znaek, and they were just considering probably the outflow from magnetic fields in the disk itself. Yeah, you're probably right about that.
That estimate is that estimate just using the Schwarzschild radius or a couple Schwarzschild radius?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So probably you could do better than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but also I'm sure you can. It wouldn't be unreasonable to have more than 1%.
There's another thing. The Blandford-Znaek effect is this numerical coefficient, which turns out to be very small.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get away from the relativistic region, I think you can also do better because of not having these redshift type factors.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you might be able to do 1,000 times better than that.
That's yeah. Not Blandford-Znaek because it has 8.5.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's it has to be. I guess they're using BZ as a generic for a magnetic outflow.
Yeah.
So really what they mean is a pointing outflow. So, but here's a calculation of the kind of A values that they get for some of their, as a function of time. So you can see that actually their A grows, at least in some of their calculations, grows to a fairly decent value, close to unity. They're Newtonian calculations. So, you know, they cannot be trusted very much. You know, and they're 2D calculations, so there are limitations. In addition, they also do neutrino physics, you know, being supernova people, because they, you know, so they want to put in the neutrino physics to see what kind of luminosities they get. But the upshot is that, yeah, the calculation is Newtonian and 2D. So. The only people who have done things like these with a relativistic code are Jim Wilson and colleagues, I forget, Grant Matthews et al. And they have gotten results which have been disagreed with other people. For instance, they have gotten in the neutron star merger case that the two neutron stars collapse to a black hole even before contact, etc.
This is incorrect.
What is the Newtonian reason that A cannot be greater than 1? Why is it limited by 1?
I don't know.
I'm not surprised by the fact that it has to plateau around 1. Why?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, good question. I should read their paper a little more carefully.
Well, see, things are happening badly in Aspen, what I get. What I'd like to know is what are they calculating while they're doing neutrino transport? Are they also calculating neutrino annihilation in the electrons?
Yeah. Yeah. So here is the let me first show what some of their disk and jet structures look like. So there's log density here, and so as you see, these kilometers. And if you look at these on a larger scale, if you boost it, and you see now this is not a relativistic jet. Okay, I mean it's the baryon loading in here is not low enough to give you relativistic values. So they do get, you know, the right geometry. They do get a jet outflow. But whether this here has a core which is highly relativistic or not, they cannot really address properly.
What value of baryon loading are you looking for?
Well, 10 to the minus 5 solar masses. So it's rather low. It's a small fraction. So you have to, you know, so I guess in terms of that's total. So if you were dividing it into shells, you know, numerical shells, you'd be really talking of having to go from on angles. You'd need a dynamical range at least of 10 to the 10, I'd guess.
Well, but I'd ask the question: what would you need to do fireball stuff?
Yeah, 10 to the -5, 10 to the -6 solar masses.
Total
in the relativistic outflow region. Well, it's in this case, you know, they say that these it's the energy deposition of the neutrino antineutrino, you know, so it's just thermal and
the neutrino outflow taking the path of least resistance.
Right. So in this case, it's not, they don't do a magnetic field simulation or anything like that.
It's just a non-symmetric supernova.
Yeah. Well, it's not a supernova. It doesn't produce.
Numerically.
Yeah, numerically, that's right. And because the accretion rate as a function of time is highly variable. So in terms of the kind of, if that translated into, so if the mass outflow rate, I guess this is what gets swallowed by the hole, but, if the mass outflow rate is modulated in a similar manner, then you would get something which is not too different from complicated light curves.
I think we have a whole spectrum. We have quasars, we have microquasars, we have everything.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Not that I believe that this microquasar is something that's usable with reality.
Yeah. Right. So that's, let me see. Okay, so I should maybe show. These tables. So these are some of the results that they have gotten from these collapsar calculation with luminosities of neutrino antineutrino annihilation and the type of rotation parameters that they obtain. And how exactly they obtain it, I guess we have to check with them when they come.
I am not concerned by the fact that it's tenant got A greater than 1. What I was concerned with was that there was asymptotic. Mm-hmm. How did it know that that was a thing?
Yeah.
Because of course, as Marek said before, small value of A could be just a bit.
Okay, well, let me.
Yeah, no, but the
it's always about the speed of light, somehow. And then it will do it.
Yeah, but it doesn't do it. So this is,
well, they use a numerical code called Prometheus, two dimensional, blah, 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 etc. So I'm just trying to see PPM, blah, blah, blah. I'm just trying to see whether they have, any modest amount of relativity. I should look at it some other time.
You're being very unkind to you. I think you're doing us a real service. And shouldn't ask you to be the
not on the fly, at any rate. Okay. But anyway, I have all these astro pH numbers, so, people are welcome to read it. Right, right. So, now, to the upshot of all of that is that you have at least, a strong argument for two things. One of them is that, there are at least five plausible binary or collapse scenarios which lead to configurations with a massive black hole and the temporary matter torus around it, whose swallowing rate or accretion rate is comparable to duration of bursts. Obviously, the energy liberated is about the right amount, and from then on, the question is, how do you convert that into a relativistic outflow, which is the one that can explain phenomenologically the gamma ray properties, the fireball shock model, etc. And so, it's been a debate between these two mechanisms. The neutrino-antineutrino annihilation at best gives you 10 to the 51 ergs isotropic. And so you have to beam it. In the case of these last objects, you'd have to beam it by at least 10 to the minus 3 or even better. So, very tight beaming. And otherwise, you play the AGN game, and so you're in the territory of starting to argue whether the magnetic field, of the torus threads the black hole or not. Even if it doesn't thread it, if you just consider an outflow, a magnetic outflow from a magnetic field which is doesn't thread the hole, so you don't do a planned Schwarzschild thing, but just take something which is, 10 to the minus 1 of the equipartition value. If you assume that the magnetic field can grow to those values, then you have the right amount of energies. Now, it seems that, you know, in the initial stages of collapse, that's not unreasonable because you do have a very strong temperature gradient. So, for instance, if you have an initial collapse, let's say, of a star to a neutron star, then right there, you know, you have convective instabilities with convective overturn times of a millisecond or so, and you can operate a turbulent dynamo, and at least in principle. And so estimates that have been made by people like Chris Thompson and Mal Rudermann and so on is that you can build up fields with a turbulent dynamo which are exceed 10 to the 15 Gauss after the matter cools down by neutrino losses, which takes of the order of 5-10 seconds. Then the temperature gradient smooths out, and then the conditions for convective instability disappear. So, you know, you can't operate these for very long. But once you have formed magnetic fields of that magnitude initially, then you have further way of doing it, you know, of boosting it up by winding up and shearing and so on.
It's funny because this turbulent dynamo in the history of astrophysics was used both to create fields and to destroy fields.
Yes, yes, that's right. So, you know,
argument of why right. Some stars are not magnetic because there was a turbulent
convection that's right.
Destroyed and mm-hmm. Why that is because
right. So, you know, we're in the usual very murky territory where, you know, we have to, hope for the best. But the thing is that, I mean, I guess the main point is that if we don't invoke that, then we don't know what to invoke. So,
you really require electromagnetic force to get the energy.
Yeah, at least with stellar mass sources.
Right. That way you can feel comfortable because we know that magnetons have magnetic fields up to 10 to 15 Gauss.
Yeah. Well, you know, that is circumstantial evidence. I think it's fairly it's strongly suggestive, and I would buy it. But again, you know, I wouldn't sort of I wouldn't believe as strongly in that magnet. You know, I mean, the status of those fields of that strength is not as strong as, say, let's say, the status that we have 10 to the 12 Gauss fields in pulsars. I think that's more believable. That's also circumstantial, but it's much more believable. 10 to the 15 Gauss is you're pushing it a little, you know,
there's
credibility, but it's plausible.
Yeah, it's plausible, but, but they are special objects.
Yeah. But that's right. So but Marek is right that
like 1916 19 and we know that the magnetic field is 10 to the 12. You cannot use this argument because it's a normal binary pulsar. If you believe, you know, you need to have some Newton star. And if you see this hypernova, it has nothing to do with this. So,
yeah, but
it is not impossible to have them. But
yeah, well, I think Marek, you know, goes a little beyond that. There is some you know evidence on these soft gamma repeaters that you have pulsations. You look at the P and the P dot, estimate magnetic field strengths, and you get you know. Of course, you're PP dot leading to a magnetic field is a whole string of assumptions, etc. But yeah, so you know, so those fields are there is some experimental and even I think one even goes a little bit beyond that. You know, there is something that is experimental evidence that is compatible. You know. Two different directions that is compatible with 10 to the 15 Gauss in one type of object.
Okay. Would you say you need strong fields both for energy and collimation?
Certainly for energy. And then for collimation, Mitch is the expert on that, but for collimation, the magnetic fields might help. Collimation is we're probably in worse conceptual shape as far as collimation than in field strength.
I think there's some really tricky issues about this.
I'm sure.
Because if you start out with some kind of magnetic field, of course, what happens depends very sensitively on the geometry.
Yeah.
But when you have a flow that's highly pointing flux dominated, the conversion of that pointing flux into kinetic energy can be very, very slow.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's very difficult. Yeah, unless you throw the stuff out initially with the final gamma that you need.
Mm-hmm.
If you started out with a fairly low gamma and you wanted to get to a high gamma, in fact, you probably have to go through a very large range of pressures to do that. So in fact, this thing may not even accelerate up to the gammas you need until you get out by two or three orders of magnitude and radius.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I know you do, but you have to calculate that because the way that happens is going to also determine the collimation you get.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're hoping Mitch will solve this problem while here at the ITP.
Well, I have a student who's working on it right now. He's coming to the meeting the week after next.
So anyway, I think I'm through with this review of what the you know the black hole formation scenarios are. But so the sort of the little schematic that one thinks of then on how the gamma ray producing fireball outflow would look like. There is both a contribution from neutrino antineutrino annihilation, and maybe that's the only real contribution we can count on. But hopefully, we can rely on a pointing outflow, a magnetically dominated outflow, and the general, the general motivation for this being a relativistic outflow is that you'll have this centrifugally evacuated cone if you have a fast enough rotating progenitor configuration, so that your baryon loading here could be low enough. And as I mentioned, you need 10 to the minus 5 solar masses in this funnel, and then here at the position of energy, which in the form of a relativistic gas, whose isotropic equivalent energy would be 10 to the 54 in the most energetic objects observed. Now, the situation is that either due to the fact that jets are observed at varying angles, or due to the fact that there is a real distribution of energy, but the effective luminosity function of bursts appears to be very broad. It appears to be at least a factor of 100, if not 1,000. And whether this is due to a projection effect, seeing jets at different angles and they're all standard energies, or whether it's a true distribution of total energies in relativistic outflow, it's unclear at the moment.
Let me ask a related question.
Yeah.
What I got out of what you're saying right now is that the class of gamma ray bursters are like blazars.
Mm-hmm.
They're accreting objects for which we happen to be looking right down the jet.
Yeah.
Now, what about all the non-blazar systems like this? Can you put limits on whether they should be astrophysically observable? I mean, what you're saying is most of the energy of the system is not coming out in the jet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Therefore, we might identify with some other kind of peculiar supernova or something.
Yeah, the thing is that the energy release in other directions is probably occurs over a much longer time scale. You have higher opacity and therefore long diffusion times, so your surface brightness will be low. But it is plausible that in the more nearby object you could see a transient at longer wavelengths, which lasts days and months, and it would have a much lower surface flux. And that hasn't been explored in great detail or at all.
Also, you can see late afterglows from the side.
Yes, that's right. You could have here, a much slower outflow. If there's a gradient of density, then your outflow here would have larger baryon loading, gamma would be low. Then you get a deceleration shock, which occurs later, days, months, whatever. And so, in fact, it could be that some of these... Getting back into the fireball business, so suppose you have the afterglow part is how should I get into that? when all that stuff starts being decelerated by the outside matter, then you create an external shock, there's a reverse shock, etc. You eventually get a power law, lock frequency, lock flux, preunit frequency, which looks something like that. The slope of these power law, alpha, can be calculated in a straightforward manner if you assume a simple set of solution, so an impulsive energy release, total energy E naught, and an initial value of gamma, which is a single number, gamma naught, one number. And then you get a simple relationship between the spectral index, F nu proportional to nu to the beta, and F in some particular band, nu, which is T to the, you know, decays in time as some other power law in time. And there is a simple relationship between the two. It seems that in some cases that has worked out, in other cases it hasn't worked out. And so then you can consider extensions of the simple model, one where you don't have just a single energy and a single gamma naught, but you have perhaps an energy which is a function of angle. Or perhaps the energy is the same per unit solid angle, but gamma depends on theta because you have a variable baryon loading. Once you do that, then you get that, you know, you get radiation from, you know, the shock here near the center of the jet, then at some later time radiation from there, and some later time radiation from there, and then you have to look at what's the light cone of each of them, and when will you start seeing each light cone. So you might get a different curve whose relationship between alpha and beta is different and depends on some of these details here. So that's one possibility. Of course, the other possibility is that the inflow, even if completely spherically symmetrical, or even if angle independent within a jet, it may be that you have a distribution of gamma, you know, some F of gamma, you know, such that you get initially, let's say, your initial outflow has higher gamma, and later on you start sending out matter which is slower and slower. The fast matter decelerates first and then it starts slowing down. It's caught up by the later arriving slow matter, so you get another type of slope. Yes?
If you have a model that uses neutrinos to accelerate the expected,
yeah,
do you get a significant flux of say 50 or 100 GeV neutrinos or something? That's detectable with Amanda, which is online now.
Yeah, the neutrino production that you get is predictable and has in fact been predicted by Eli Waxman and John Bacall and Mario Vietri and Jörg Rachen. You can produce neutrinos just because of the fact that in the internal shocks that you get in these outflow, you get internal shocks. You accelerate not only electrons but protons, and so the protons, you can accelerate them. In fact, if you calculate the theoretical maximum energy of the protons, it happens to be 10 to the 20 electron volts. And so the obvious case has been made that perhaps these are sources of 10 to the 20 electron volt cosmic rays. But in addition, those protons then will interact with the radiation field, the photon field produced by the electrons in the shocks themselves, and then so you get photopion production, and you make neutrinos with that. And so the spectrum of neutrinos produced by these internal shocks has been calculated. Eli Waxman will be talking about that in the conference. The fluxes are, in principle, within the range that is detectable by Amanda, yeah. And so, in fact, you know, Francis Holson, I'm sure, has made that point, and that's one reason why people like you know, Eli and I and so on have been approached by this thing. Yes?
Can you deduce from the calculation somehow the profile of the burst?
Yeah. Well, the time profile of the burst, In the gamma ray range, you can make, and the people who have been doing these are actually Aline Panaitescu and Maddalena Spada. You can assume that you have the central engine, that thing, and it's sending out puffs of relativistic matter in the form of shells of matter, which have some distribution f of gamma and some distribution f of the mass or of the total energy, and then these at some point they'll collide with each other. You can assume also a distribution of how they are sent out, but it's all arbitrary. Okay, so f of some initial e. Initial as a function of time, and then you can convert that into gamma ray light curves as a function of time. So they've been doing that kind of calculations, and the thing is that one cannot predict initially what the rate and the distribution of energy will be, except through numerical calculations such as done by Ruffert and Woosley and others. But those don't yet produce relativistic outflow, so we cannot really use them as an input. So, what people have been doing is assuming either random distributions or here of these input parameters, such that the global properties satisfy physical constraints and observational constraints, or trying to put some correlation between these quantities that are compatible with the dynamics, chaotic dynamics that we infer in these disrupting flows, and then see, whether those reproduce the general properties of the light curves. And so Aline and Maddalena have done such calculations where they compare, the power density spectra of the gamma ray light curves with those obtained from the BATSE catalog, and that is work in progress, but there are input parameters that are known.
And the profile?
Yes, the profiles are observed. Yes, the one definitely observes light profiles, light curves in gamma rays, which some of them are very smooth and some of them are very spiky, but things like that. And so. Yes. Well, there is a the gamma ray instruments, they're observing all the time, and at some point if the intensity goes above background in more than one channel by a certain amount, then a trigger. Depends on the instrument, but the energy channels, some of them are 20 or 30 kilovolts wide. Yeah. So yeah, the resolutions that have been obtained are, some of them are as short as. Well, there are many that are milliseconds, and very little, right? Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So there could be two classes.
Yes.
I always had the problem with gamma rays. You just look at the catalog and see all these light curves. It's so difficult to believe that they come from one type of process. I've never seen it so like that. They are so different. How can they come from just a black hole and the torus?
Well, if it's chaotic, no, the thing is, no, I mean, I should.
So they are saying that all the bursts are kind of random extraction from random events from a well-defined neuron.
Right. So, you know, so if you have these disks, let's say, that lives for, let's say, 100 seconds, and you say that because of, the shearing that produces instabilities, that produces ballooning out of field, that sends out a puff, that all that occurs at random, okay, then you can sort of, you know, use such a machine for producing random puffs and some distribution of Lorentz factors and masses associated, and you look at the light curves they produce, the profiles of the light curves, gamma ray light curves you get, they look like the observations, and some of the properties of the power density spectrum do reproduce the observed properties, not all of them, but I don't think it's I think it's a close enough similarity that you get that, you know, that you don't have any obvious reason to disbelieve it.
In fact, the light curve
I think that this is the typical scheme of how you envisage the shocks, right? So you have the outflow, which might be jet-like or spherical or whatever, and the bulk Lorentz factor, just from the dynamics, as long as it's optically thick evolution, bulk Lorentz factor initially grows, then saturates, becomes constant, and at some point you get these internal shocks, you know, so faster shells catch up with slower shells, so you get internal shocks, and so that's what can give you here a very spiky gamma ray light curve. Then at some later time, all these shells that have collided with each other, they all more or less have acquired, they continue to coast, they still have a center of mass motion, they have dissipated their random energies relative to each other, but, you know, the rest still continues moving on. And you get an external shock. And now, so there's been a debate. You can, in principle, get gamma rays from both the external shock and the internal shocks. And the thing is that the external shocks, they would produce smoother light curves. Now, some light curves, about 30% of the gamma ray light curves are smooth. It's possible that, you know, we're observing that kind of shocks and these kind of shocks. And in fact, in situations, you would expect both of them. Alternatively, depending on what the magnetic field strengths are, see, I mean, in order to get gamma rays, you have to assume that the magnetic fields build up in the shock, and you have to assume, as in supernova, that the magnetic fields build up by, especially in the external shock, that they build up by turbulent dynamo. Okay, so depending on how strong it is, it might be that here, you know, your synchrotron radiation is not in the gamma ray range, but it's at lower energies, and then you might produce GeV photons by inverse Compton, so that perhaps then you know, you only see gamma rays from here, and from the external shock you'd see maybe optical and GeV radiation, but not MeV. So there are various combinations, and so, you know, it's uncertain because the magnetic field value is uncertain, and the other thing that's uncertain is the degree of coupling between protons and electrons. To be energetically efficient, you need a good degree of coupling, but you know, to explain the spectra, you need to the minimum Lorentz factor of the electrons will be related somehow to the bulk Lorentz factor of the shock. And so the minimum bulk Lorentz factor, the minimum random Lorentz factor may be related to how good the coupling or the energy partition between electrons and protons is.
And so, external shock does rather longer time scale.
Well, the typical duration of the external shock in the observer frame is. It can be long depending on what the bulk Lorentz factor is, but the typical duration of the external one is of the order of the radius at which deceleration occurs divided by C, and average gamma squared. Now for gammas of a thousand, these goes as a fairly steep function. The deceleration radius will depend on gamma, so these goes as gamma to the minus 8/3, I believe. So for gammas 1,000, you get here about a second duration, but for gamma 100, you get something like, more like 500 or 1,000 seconds, so the longer things. Yeah. So these, if gamma were 100, then you would be getting longer things, 500 to 1,000 seconds. For gamma 1,000, you would be getting 1 second, so it could be short.
Then, with respect to C,
Yes, you would. So that's why I was saying that in the naive picture that both of them are efficient in the same energy range of the BATSE detectors, which are the ones that have done the bulk of the survey. The BATSE detectors range extends from 20 kilovolt to about 1 MeV. So it's a relatively narrow energy range compared to the radiation spectrum from synchrotron and inverse compton, which can extend over 10 decades. So you may be sampling only a very small range of energy. And so if your parameters are such that your energy synchrotron peak or your inverse compton peak doesn't fall in the BATSE window, you could be missing one or the other. So but if both of them were within the BATSE window, yes, then you would expect two bursts, and some bursts are double peaked. So that proposition has also been made. The rub is that you would expect the last one to be smoothish, and I think the data is not good enough, and our understanding of these things is not good enough that we can make up our mind whether that's what we're seeing or not.
Also, yes? They can overlap.
They can overlap, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think is the strongest cruise strain on gamma?
Sorry?
What do you think is the strongest cruise strain on gamma?
Well, the strongest constraint on gamma is really just physical. It's not observational, I don't think. There is one observational constraint, which comes from the fact that you observe GeV photons, and the GeV photons. Now there are GeV photons, in the Super Bowl bursts. No, they've been observed in 6 bursts. GeV photons. Well. In the famous Super Bowl burst, there were GeV photons already in the initial spike, as well as 1 hour later.
Okay.
But there were some already immediately there at the beginning. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, at least within 10 seconds. So in that case, you can argue that with the energies you require and the distances, you can compute the usual argument of the compactness, that you can compute the photon density at the source, and it's so high that you would have had photon-photon interactions degrading the GeV photons to something less than MeV, yet you observe the GeV photons, and the only plausible way out of that is that the whole thing is moving with a high Bork-Lorentz factor, so that the photons that you observe are ones that have interacted at a shallow angle, and then you can avoid these, since the photon-photon cross section is angle dependent. At a shallow angle, the threshold goes up, and so you can escape these degradation argument. So that's the observational argument, and the theoretical argument is that you would just produce if you didn't have a relativistic outflow, then your optical depth would be again so large that you would be producing a thermal spectrum whose peak would be at MeV and would never extend to GeVs. The spectrum would be rounded, etc., and you would you'd be extremely inefficient. So the theoretical types. Also, your time scales would be very long because you'd have to deal with photon diffusion times, which would be years. So you really need to get an optically thin situation. You need to have this high Bok-Lorentz factor and produce shocks outside of the photosphere.
How sensitive do these models? How sensitively do these models depend on the Raman density in the external medium?
Well, they okay. So the gamma ray light curve, if it's produced by the internal shocks, it's insensitive to the external density. Now, the afterglows, which come from these external shock and how it decays as you pile up more and more matter. So the afterglows in the X-ray and optical, those the decay index in time does depend on what you assume for the runoff density. So in particular, for a power law density, external density dropping off as a power law with distance, you get a different slope of the time decay. And so in fact, there is a degeneracy there. We could be getting a slope because of the density run or because of other factors like these angular dependencies and so on. So these are the so-called, post-standard features of the standard fireball model. Namely, once you start dropping the assumption that the external medium is homogeneous and that the explosion is impulsive and has only a single energy and a single gamma, then you start getting into these other ways of making power laws, which are somewhat degenerate.
Why do you think
that
Pacini's
model
is
less than
the
discussion?
Pacini?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think Pacini's hypernova model is plausible, but it's one of those that is there. It's the collapsar model. It's you assume that you have a massive.
All the emissions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same. It's the same as these. It's the same picture. Sure.
Why?
Yeah. Now, if you do that, then you get very short time scales, and you get the opacity. So you still need to have the relativistic outflow. So the only difference is that in the hypernova, you argue that you have these massive envelope, and somehow you get this channel along the rotation axis, and your outflow occurs there. And you can do things, it may be that these iron lines that Lippo-Sack sees are perhaps due to the fact that we have a hypernova progenitor. So I guess this is another thing that, there's a whole stuff here that I haven't talked about, but if you had a hypernova model, so you have fast rotating star and so it collapses and makes the black hole and you evacuate a little funnel and I guess the proper centrifugal funnel is probably maybe paraboloidal or whatever. So you might have here your outflow, okay, and you get your internal shocks here producing the gamma rays, but you'll have radiation, and then you might form your maybe there is higher density here, so perhaps your internal shocks occur here, your outer shock, external shock perhaps occurs here, and so that's the source of the afterglow. So here you start, after you have done with the gamma rays, you might still be producing X-rays, and the X-rays might hit the envelope, and so they can produce iron lines via just scattering fluorescence, yeah. And Beppo-Sachs has, both Beppo-Sachs and Aska have separate observations of separate objects where the X-ray spectrum, F nu, log nu, has typical X-ray spectrum of the afterglow plus 3 sigma bump at the iron line energy. Redshifted. So in 97, 0508, where the redshift is known to be, what was it? It was the 0.96 or whatever, right? Redshift was 0.96. The iron line, which is comes at 6.7 kV, was redshifted down to the right amount, which was, you know, 3.2 kV. And in another burst, so that was the Beppo-Sachs observation, but 3 sigma, okay, 3 sigma detection. And in another burst, which I forget the number, but that was observed by ASCA, there was they played around until they found a bump. The redshift wasn't known for that object, wasn't measured, still hasn't been measured optically because the optical flux was poor, but you know, they deduced a from the position of the bump saying that that's an iron line. Well, you know, so again they get a 3 sigma, what might be considered a 3 sigma detection of an iron line if you assume a redshift of 1.5 or whatever it was.
And you mean this iron line is emitted at the rest frequency, that is not
Well, the you know the stellar envelope is the outer part is collapsing sub-relativistically, or it's even stationary. You know, it could be out of so you know it's non-relativistic. No, there's only gravitational redshift. I mean, cosmological redshift. Yeah. So yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, I could have done a more elaborate talk on the various manifestations of gamma ray bursts, but sorry.
No, this is very good. No, I think you talked about the important issues.
So it looks like a blazer.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so you know. Yeah, they're. That's right. The physics and the phenomenology really resembles that of blazers, and Igor Mirabel, you know, sort of always complains that, you know, we don't make enough of an analogy with the mini quasars. But the thing is that
they don't repeat.
The evidence that they don't repeat. Well, the evidence is that. The limits are not tremendous. In the whole BATSE catalog of 2,500 bursts or so, you can, you know, just put limits that I think the current limits are that less than 10% of them can be repeaters, if they are. The positional errors of the BATSE catalog are very poor. You know, few degrees. So based on coincidences within those error boxes and time coincidences, you know, less than 10% of them can repeat. And so the thing is that in those bursts where there has been good positions from the IPN, you know, interplanetary network, none of those has been seen to repeat. So. Yeah. Yes. Right. So the repetition time is longer than 5 years, which being the lifetime of BATSE. Yeah.
There's a very interesting problem related to these hypernova ideas, because if you try to bring out this thing through the center of a very optically thick medium,
uh-huh.
and the flow itself starts out optically thick, you have a tremendous amount of radiation viscosity. You're going to get a boundary layer. And there's nothing you can do about that. And you're going to dump a lot of the energy into material that's not moving at extremely high depths.
Yeah.
You calculate that, I mean.
That's right. Yeah, the thing is that, so you're talking of reprocessing the radiation from the central jet?
Well, you're going to decelerate some of the central jet, and you're going to get a lot of radiation.
That's right, yeah. So
you're going to have a region that's not highly deep, no matter what you do.
That's right. Right.
So the same thing happens probably mm-hmm. in SS-433.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so in fact there are very interesting things to calculate there. I mean, you know, some of these calculations are being done by Chris Vett at Penn State, but you know, you these business, and they're somewhat similar to what people do in the AGN reflection models, where you start assuming, you know, not that you have a plain flat disk and some source above, but where you assume you have something like a funnel. So some people like Neil Brandt, I think, have done some of these reflection models with a conical interior surface. So, but they're all non-self-consistent.
So, I mean, you should use the diffusion approximation.
Well, you mean here the outflow here would be optically thick? Well, you know, if it's optically thick, then you're sort of moving into a different type of object and not a gamma ray burst. So, you know, you'll get a gamma ray burst only if you're able to produce the relativistic outflow here so that your optical depths are smallish.
Well, it comes off the thin eventually.
Right, right.
Exactly.
Yeah. But initially, all these fireballs are optically thick. Right? I mean, all of these are optically thick up to here, then they recombine. They do a little.
I guess what I'm saying is that you have to make sure you don't entrain so much of the surrounding hypernova that it slows the thing down.
Right, that's right.
That's the constraint that you've naturally
calculated. Yeah, and it hasn't been calculated, so I guess it's another thing we'll do these next few weeks. Yeah. But no, I mean, you're right. No, we're being flippant, I think.
It's already been done, so it needs to generalize to relativity.
Yeah.
Well, if this has whetted your appetite, remember there'll be a whole week on gamma ray bursts.
Yeah, during this time probably we will have our
seminar. Probably not. As it comes closer, we got to think about whether we need to have coffee in the morning or whether we should just
give up. Nobody's forced to go to the
meeting. Yeah, right.
But seminars would be.
Yeah.